We are surrounded by nature's bounty in our region. Many of us live here because of the mountains and the ocean and the trees, even if we don't get around to visiting them as often as we might like. Today's guest appreciates the wonders of nature in our region and elsewhere and writes about it a lot. David Raines Wallace is a nature writer and has been for three decades. He's written 18 books, including 1984's The Klamath Knot. David Raines Wallace collects 23 of his essays into a new book called Articulate Earth, Adventures in Eco-Criticism. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange today. David, welcome.
Good morning.
It's very good to have you here. Let's start with the big stuff. What is eco-criticism?
Well, criticism, is a kind of like neglected art nowadays. People associate it with, academic stuff and kind of dull theoretical things. But criticism has always been a really important part of writing, Adam, because most creative writing isn't really that good. So there has to be somebody to sort of winnow out the wheat from the chaff, and I think that's an exciting thing to do. So I've done, becoming a writer, you have to do a lot of reading, and so I've done a lot of, over the years, as newspapers or magazines have hired me to criticize stuff, I've done that, and then I thought I'd put together a collection of that, eco-criticism, I think, is a kind of a new aspect of criticism, in that traditionally criticism has taken a kind of a cultural viewpoint of things, because civilization, civilization has a certain set of standards that they apply to things, but with the growth of evolution and science, it's become possible to criticize civilization from a kind of an ecological viewpoint. So that's what eco-criticism is, and I'd take Thoreau's Walden as the beginning of eco-criticism in a way. I mean, people think, it's just a guy who goes out in the woods and, thinks about himself. But actually, there's an awful lot of criticism of civilization in that book. And that book is kind of a critique from the woods of civilization. So that's what I've been trying to do in my writing of that kind. And so I put together a manuscript and was circulating it. And then Bill Forbes at Backcountry Press expressed interest, and that gave me the idea of most of the stuff had been about books. That gave me the idea of including for several magazine or newspaper pieces that I'd written about, the Klamath region as a result of, having done the Klamath Knot and being interested in conservation up there. So I included those, which was, a great thing, because they've been sort of floating around. You write a book and people get interested in that, but then articles and essays that aren't collected are kind of fall through the cracks. So it was a great opportunity to bring back some of that stuff. I wrote an essay in the early 90s called The Klamath Surprise. Forestry meets biodiversity in the Northwest, and that's about the conflicts between trying to wilderness preservation and forestry in the Klamath, which have been I think a real important sort of issue. Biodiversity, people tend to associate biodiversity with the tropics where there is a lot of it, but it took a while longer to associate that with the temperate forests, and since the Klamaths are among the most biodiverse temperate forests in the world, that came into a pretty important issue, which I was happy to be involved with my book, The Klamath Knot.
Well, and in fact, part two of the book is Jeffersoniana, Northern California and Southern Oregon, so it speaks very much to the region that we broadcast to, and
seven
essays in there, one of which is this one called The Klamath Surprise, and it is, apparently it continues to surprise that people just don't realize quite how diverse the Klamath Mountains are.
Yeah, it is strange that they're so sort of slow to pick up on that. I think part of the reason is that the mass media, they tend to concentrate on these really spectacular things, places like places with a lot of big animals or And the you know, the Klamaths, the biodiversity is more subtle. I mean, it's a lot. I mean, Michael, you know, at Backcountry Press, you know, he's focused on the conifers, and that's really sort of the center of biodiversity, and because they have so many more conifers here, more conifer biodiversity here than any other temperate forest in the world.
We have talked to the author of Conifer Country and Conifers of the Pacific Slope. He's been on the program twice.
You know, it's but people, you know, they people just people. A lot of people have trouble identifying trees. I mean, I've even talked to botanists who said, well, you know, I'd say, well, that's a. I was in Costa Rica with a botanist, and I said, well, that's a pachote tree. And he said, well, how do you tell the difference between these trees? Because, you know, so much of science now is getting down to the cellular and biochemical level, and a lot of botanists, a lot of biologists don't even know can't even tell the species apart. So you can't really expect the average person to have much insight into that. And I think that's why it's so important for, you know, people like Michael, you know, to be writing about you know, the great diversity of the conifers there. He's really done a tremendous job of you know, discovering some stands of, you know, rare species that haven't been found anywhere else.
Some real islands of diversity way up there in the mountains. And so we're talking to David Raines Wallace here in the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is a collection of essays from throughout his decades of writing about nature. Articulate Earth, Adventures in Eco-Criticism is the title of this book. We'll come back and talk more with David and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join him to talk about the state of nature or the state of nature writing. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back with David Raines Wallace and Nature and You in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the nature writer David Raines Wallace. After 18 books or so, he's compiled a number of his essays into a new one called Articulate Earth, Adventures in Eco-Criticism. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about nature, writing about nature, critiques of mankind and mankind's approach to nature, humankind, sorry. And much more. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, email address jx@jeffnet.org. David, what does the term Articulate Earth mean?
Well, it's a title of one of the essays in the book. You know, there's sort of a rival between the East Coast and the West Coast, you know, toward literary things, and one of the things that East Coast critics have tended to say about the West Coast is that you know, they're not very literary. They're sort of they're more interested in nature than they are in culture. George Santayana, a Harvard philosophy professor, said at one point you know, that Californians have a kind of an inarticulate worship of nature, but in my opinion, California is a very good place to have an articulate to understand nature is very articulate, because it's so diverse, and the diversity is so pronounced. Like you know, in the Klamath region, you can go from redwoods to several entirely different kinds of forests to meadows to, you know, and then the east side you get into sagebrush and stuff. So so that's in a way the earth is speaking that way. You know, it's the earth is not inarticulate if you pay attention to it.
Let's take a call. We have Dave in the Siskiyou Mountains is the only location he gives. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Raines Wallace.
Hey, David, it's good to hear from you again. I'm glad you got a new book out. I love
Thank
all
you.
Your work. And
Great.
I'm a biologist here in the Siskiyou Mountains, and I met you several years ago. And love your book, Klamath Knot, although I gave you guff about red-legged frogs being at Lily Pad Lake. And
Yeah,
the new biologists.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that. Yeah, I think they were actually, at the time they were, you know, Pacific tree frogs. Now they're Pacific chorus frogs. I mean, biologists, you keep changing the names around. You know, you make it hard for us writers. I mean,
that's our job. That's what we do. You know, we also identify the new salamander down on the Klamath.
Right. Yeah, well, good to talk to you again.
Go ahead, Dave.
The turquoise dragon is required reading for all my new biologists, and I'm really looking forward to reading your new book, and I just really appreciate that you appreciate the Siskiyou Mountains and the Klamath Knot, and that you're aware of the incredible diversity we have here, prone to endemism, and that, you know, it's not as dramatic as other areas, but this is a very special place, and can't wait to read your new book. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
You're talking about the Klamath Knot here, and I want to ask what it was you were trying to do when you wrote the Klamath Knot, which came out about 31 years ago, and why did the New York Times jump on it?
Well, the first question is easier to answer than the second. I was attracted to the Klamaths because of what, you know, Dave was just talking about, because they're so diverse and the forest is it's so rich and just the first time I was there it just seemed like such a mysterious rich place to me. And of course the stories about Bigfoot contributed to that. I've always been a fan of science fiction and fantasy. I think a lot of people go through that stage, and there seems to be kind of a link between the folklore of that and the forest itself. They seem to be, and then of course the Native American cultures are very, rich part of the region too, and a lot of that giant lore comes from there. So John Muir, who loved the Sierras, called them the Range of Light. And I see the Klamath as sort of a complement in a way. I mean, you can't have day without night. I mean, if it was day all the time, we'd all burn up. So you got to have your periods of darkness too, and sort of, you know, mystery. And I think the Klamaths, they really epitomize that to me. You know, the mystery of nature. I call my first book, which is about the Yolaboli wilderness down at the south end of the region, the Dark Range, and I think of and another interesting aspect of the Klamaths is the Marble Mountain wilderness has the second largest cave system in the West underneath it, which I didn't even know at the time I was writing the Klamath Knot. But that seems another aspect of, like, and you know, Muir's climbing to the peaks, but there's also the caves, and there's really a lot of interesting Oregon Caves National Monument, which should be enlarged, and I hope it's going to be enlarged. It's now like 400 acres, which is ridiculously small.
I think the bill did pass at the end of the year.
Yeah. Well, that's great. That's great. But of course, it should be even bigger than that. I think we should have a national park, you know, centered on Oregon caves. I mean, you know, extending from the, you know, the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument over to, you know, including the Red Buttes wilderness. I think that would make a great new national park.
But that's something that that Dave just touched on in his call, and you touched on in your essays in this book, Articulate Earth, is the sense, and you even said so yourself, about we tend to focus on big things, you know, big animals, and
yeah.
I'll extend that to big trees. You know, we have the Redwoods Park for big
right.
trees. We have
right.
we have the Yosemite for big pieces of rock and stuff like that. But it's really hard to make a case, apparently, for something like a national park for the Klamath Mountains, because it's not like there's any one thing. It's there are so many things.
Yeah, well, that's why I say we should make a park for many things. Costa Rica, which is sort of the a leader in national parks now. I mean, they base their park system on biodiversity. It's not, of course, there's spectacular things there too, but why not have a new kind of national park that's based on many things and not just, these big rocks sticking up or big trees sticking up. Not that the big things aren't important too, but I think the little things. There are really important, three really important things about the Klamath Mountains that would certainly justify a national park: is the forest, the most diverse possibly in the world, temperate, the nadromous fishery, which is one of the last healthy ones on the in the lower 48, and then the indigenous cultures, which are some of the most diverse and vibrant, remaining in the lower 48. So just those three, I think, would justify a park. And then there's all this other stuff too. The many species of amphibians and many fish diversity, and just the diversity of smaller plants too, shrubs and western yew and the beautiful wildflowers. I think definitely need a national park in those Klamath Mountains.
And yes, I went back and checked mid-December, President Obama signed the National Defense Authorization Act, which included the expansion of the Oregon Caves by 4,070 acres.
Okay.
Which is about the size that that President Taft first envisioned when he signed it into law in 1909?
When it was first signed, it was 400 acres, and it remained 400 acres. I wrote, articles advocating its enlargement, back 20 years ago, and it took such an incredibly long time just to get this, 4,000 acres. I mean, that's a regional park. That's not a national park. It's got to be, and I think it will be enlarged in the future. Although I may not live to see it, but
it took a long time just to get this far. David Raines Wallace is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book, a compilation of essays from more than 30 years of nature writing, is called Articulate Earth, Adventures in Eco-Criticism, with a full section on Jeffersoniana from our part of the world. I mean, a lot of it focuses on our part of the world anyway. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the discussion. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. David, you described several periods in nature writing and figures, you've already mentioned Thoreau, ranging from Thoreau to Rachel Carson and beyond. Is there an overall tone in nature writing in the current period?
Could I just mention Michael Kaufman asked me to say this, that the book is available at the Northwest Nature Shop in Ashland.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Sure, yeah. And Michael Kaufman is the one who was our guest. He wrote Conifer Country and Conifers of the Pacific Slope.
Little advertisement there, but, if people want to get the book, they should know where to get it. But,
okay.
To answer your question, a couple of the essays in the book are about, sort of the nature of nature writing. In fact, the first critical essay I wrote was in the New York Times, called The Nature of Nature Writing, and I talked about nature writing as an aspect of conservation, which is, I think, it's been a very powerful driver of conservation in the writing of Thoreau, Muir, Carson, Leopold, and I think that's its main importance socially. When I started doing it, it had sort of fallen into abeyance. Literary genres sort of have their ups and downs, but that was in the early, in the 70s, when the environmental movement was starting to get going, and as a result of the environmental movement, nature writing really sort of took off, and a lot of writers were writing in the genre as well as me, it sort of began to bother me over the next few decades that nature writing wasn't having the influence on conservation that it had with Muir and Leopold, and I think it's hard to give reasons for that. Of course, the sort of and all kind of literary influences sort of decline because of the mass media. People are watching television instead of reading books. But it seemed to me also that I mean, the basis of nature writing is to write about, go out into the woods and write about nature, and try to observe as much as you can. A lot of the writing that was being done in the last few decades, I mean, it's been about that, but it's also been more kind of intellectually oriented or culturally oriented, so that, you know, you've had nature writers who are writing from Buddhist viewpoint or a Christian viewpoint or a left-wing viewpoint or right-wing viewpoint. It sort of seems like some of them were writing more about themselves than they were about nature. And I think, well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But, what about the nature? I mean, what about the function of protecting nature that Muir and Thoreau and Leopold had? And in fact, there's a movie out now, I guess based on a book called Wild, that's about a woman who hikes the Pacific Crest Trail.
Right, Cheryl Strayed. She was our guest a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and part of it's set in Ashland, I guess.
Yeah,
I haven't read it or seen it, but I read a review of it, and it said that she did this in order to find herself, which seems, like you got to walk 1,000 miles through the woods to find yourself. I mean, I guess, it can have that function, but what about the woods, you know? I mean, I think that the important thing about nature writing is nature. It's, I think an important aspect of that is people discovering things about themselves in relation to nature. That's what Thoreau was doing in a way, moving it. But he wasn't just, writing. He wasn't looking for himself, I think, at Walden Pond. He was.
Well, it worked. She found herself. She did. She was successful ultimately. David Raines Wallace is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of The Klamath Knot from years ago and a new book called Articulate Earth, Adventures in Eco-Criticism that compiles his essays, 23 of his essays. You mentioned Aldo Leopold a couple times here. This is the guy who essentially created the science of wildlife management. And how much static did he get from coworkers and supervisors over the years?
Yeah, well, you don't. It's kind of hard to find out because organizations tend to be kind of, secretive about those conflicts. Leopold was one of the first Forest Service workers. He managed forests in the Southwest, and he was an enthusiastic hunter. And as he saw the woods being sort of carved up, he got worried about being able to take a 2-week pack trip into the woods. So he came up with this idea of the National Forest Wilderness Area, and was able to push that through. That were the first wilderness area in the Gila Wilderness in New Mexico. But there's sort of two factions: the Forest Service, one is for protecting the wilderness, and the other is the industrial foresters. And I think that Leopold sort of ran afoul of industrial forestry because, he was transferred from the Southwest, where he was working with these wilderness and wildlife issues, to a forest products lab in Wisconsin. So he eventually left the Forest Service and had a tough time for a few years, I think, trying to be a freelance wildlife manager. That wasn't in the 1930s. That wasn't exactly a growth industry. But the University of Wisconsin eventually gave him a chair in wildlife management, and from there he was able to, get the Wilderness Society started, which eventually resulted in the Wilderness Act, which eventually resulted in these wilderness areas we have in the Klamath Mountains, Marble Mountain, Ulibulli, eventually Trinity Alps and Siskiyou.
David, you do find the contradictions in people. I mean, there's a part in here where you're writing about Rachel Carson and the gift she bought herself.
Right.
Oh, that's just an amazing story. Relate that one,
coat.
Would you? Yeah, the fur coat.
Uh-huh. Mink coat, yeah. Well, she was a realist. She wasn't, she wasn't starry-eyed. She dealt with real life. And one of the aspects of being an author is to you have to appear in public and make yourself presentable, and having a nice mink coat was an aspect of that. As I said, Leopold was an enthusiastic hunter. I mean, which some people, you know, I've taught nature writing classes, and some people don't like his. He has an appetizing recipe for venison in Sand County Almanac, and you know, some people don't like that. I'm a little, you know, ambivalent about it myself. I'm, you know, killing for fun, but or killing for, you know, to for, you know,
sport rather than for food,
for ladies to wear fur coats. But when you balance that against what Rachel Carson accomplished, I think, you know, you have to cut her a little slack. You know,
you write that she didn't want to. She did not want to write Silent Spring. Why not?
No, well, it was a horrible job, you know, to research all that awful, you know, all the horrible things that pesticides have been doing. Clear Lake, you know, they virtually killed Clear Lake with up there in Lake County with pesticides, and you know, animals, eggshell thinning, and I mean, it's not fun to write about that stuff, but nobody else would do it.
Right, and so she finally had to, and
yeah, and she had the, you know, she had the. Because you know she had the information and the kind of the milieu to do it, so she did it. But it was really tough for her. No doubt about that.
David Raines Wallace, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Articulate Earth: Adventures in Eco-Criticism. We'll talk more about writing about nature and nature itself and the state thereof when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with you in a minute five. Final segment on this Friday edition of the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening to us on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Our guest is the writer David Raines Wallace, writing about nature for 30 years plus. His latest book is a compilation of essays from through the years. It's called Articulate Earth: Adventures in Eco-Criticism from Backcountry Press, which also put out also Conifer Country and Conifers of the Pacific Slope. Author Michael Kaufman joined us to talk about both of those books in the past. You can join us to talk about nature and nature writing as David Raines Wallace discusses it here on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, around and about the region, and 800-838-3760 works anywhere here. jx@jeffnet.org is our email address, and I want to get into the part of the book called Jeffersoniana just a little further, because it deals specifically with the region in which we live and broadcast. Are there any corners of the region? I mean, you've obviously covered much of it. Any corners you've wanted to visit and have not yet reached, David?
Well, I've never gotten to the Rogue wilderness, you know, that far north. And then there's a little wilderness down below the Trinity Alps called, I think, the Chensalula that I haven't been into.
But a lot of it you hit. I mean, and obviously, as you pointed out, you've gone very high and very low, too. Did you actually get into those caves that you didn't realize existed in the Trinity area?
Well, no. They're not, you know, you can't just walk into them. They're gated. And also, they're at such high elevation that the temperature's so low that there's not a lot of fauna in them. And I like fauna. And one of the fascinating things about Oregon caves is it does have a very diverse fauna because it's at a lower elevation. So when I, you know, by the time I found out about the caves, you know, I wasn't a spring chicken anymore. And I've done some caving at Mammoth Cave in Kentucky, and it's, you know, pretty strenuous. It's not the kind of thing you want to do by yourself. You have to, you know, I like to go into the wilderness by myself. I think, you know, a lot of people say that's not a good idea, and I wouldn't recommend it. But you know, just to have a complete focus on you know, the place itself, to me, is important.
We talked a fair bit last year about the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, and it prompts a question about where we stand in terms of protection versus exploitation, and how what we've gotten to matches what your hopes or expectations might have been years ago.
Are we
doing a good job protecting things? Or are we a lot more ground to cover?
No, I don't think we are. I think, you know, the impetus. Political, you know, impetus toward protection has really fallen off. partly because, you know, we have all these other issues, you know, the wars, I think it's like this really unfinished agenda of parks. I think Costa Rica has 25, a large percentage of its area in the national park system. Even Japan and England are, you know, really crowded places, have a larger percentage of their land in national parks than we do. So I think, you know, and there's a lot of really important ecosystems that aren't included in our national park system. Most important of all is the Great Plains. I mean, that was the first national park idea was conceived by an artist named George Catlin, who explored the plains in the 1840s and was so fascinated with the Native American cultures there that he thought, you know, he said, well, why don't we have a great national park here where the Native American cultures can continue the way they are? I mean, it was sort of a naive idea, but I think it's still a great one. I think we should try to do that. We should. Wild bison survival, I think, is going to depend on getting some kind of a big park up there in the northern Great Plains. And I think it's possible because it's, you know, I think it's proving that agriculture is not working that well there, and bison are better adapted to that environment than cattle. That's just one example. I think the Klamaths are another big one where, you know, we have all these, we have a lot of, as they say, wilderness on the rocks, you know, in places like Yosemite, but we don't have that many places with wilderness in the deep forest like the Klamaths. So, I think we need to, you know, at least double the size of our national park system. I'm not too good on figures. I don't remember exactly what the percentage is now, but... And compared to, these other little countries, you know, mm-hmm. which you think, you know, would be
land might
behind
be a premium,
us.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we were the leader. I mean, that was, as they say, I mean, that was the one great idea that the United States has given to the world is the national park, and now we're sort of lagging behind. We've become the kind of the, you know, Detroit Rust Belt of the national parks.
All right, we have some calls for you. Let's take them. Here's Ann in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Raines Wallace.
Hi, thanks. I was really enjoying listening to you talking about the Sand County Almanac. A friend of mine had edited a companion to the Sand County Almanac called That by J. Baird Callicott.
Yes, I've written. In fact, I reviewed that for the New York Times, and I write. I mention it in my new book. In fact, I write about it in the Articulate Earth.
Oh, great! Mm-hmm. So, because that's where I'm from, but then I moved to Kentucky, which is like one of the other high diversity areas.
Yeah, the Appalachians. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I learned, you know, how to identify things in Wisconsin, and mm-hmm. then it, you know. It's even harder to do that in Kentucky, and now I'm here, mm-hmm. which is another, you know, level of difficulty. But my main question is, I just bought the Klamath Knot. It's 30 years old now, and I'm on page 7, and I was wondering if you know much about how the climate change is affecting that area.
All right, good question. Thanks for that, Ann.
Yeah, there's so much talk about this, not being an expert in, you know, in climatology, I had trouble saying. I think the big fires that have been in the Klamaths recently, you know, 97 and 2002, and I think that might have something to do with it, but also has to do with forest management where, you know, I mean, fire has always been a big part of the forest regime in the Klamath, so it's hard to say. And then, you know, to things like Port Orford cedar, the way they're, which is endangered by an imported fungus, what effects a drying, warming climate would have on that, it's certainly evident that the Klamath's biodiversity has been affected by rising climate in the past because know, whereas in the Sierra, you have these high elevation animals like bighorn sheep and pikas and marmots. You don't have them in the Klamaths. They've evidently been exterminated there by the warming. So I guess, you know, as warming, if warming continues, then more high elevation things will start to disappear there. On the other hand, I don't know, more low elevation things will start to appear too. It's a very complex issue, and you know, it's sort of in a way, I see it as part of the problem of, you know, of dilution of concern about environmental problems, because everybody's talking about climate change now, but who's talking about population growth or resource depletion or, you know, pollution? Those are the three basics of the environmental movement in the 1970s, and that's sort of gotten lost in the shuffle of climate change. I mean, we're in a way we're my basic idea about, you know, the biosphere is that it is wild. You know, it's 3 billion years old, and we can't expect to control it. But when we're talking about things like putting up big walls to stop the ocean from, you know, rising and drowning our cities because we're changing the climate, I mean, that seems kind of crazy to me. I mean, what we should be doing, I think, is reducing our own population and our own demands on the biosphere so that we'll be able to adapt to it instead of trying to change it to our specifications of always wanting to, you know, grow.
Let's take another call. Here's Joseph from Green Springs. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Raines Wallace.
Uh-huh. Hello. Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, Joseph.
I wanted to go back and discuss a little bit more. I've been hitting and missing the conversation on the national parks, and I don't profess to be an expert or anything. I do have a forest resources degree from Oregon State 20 years ago, and have lived in Southern Oregon for my whole life. I've traveled to, I think, almost every national park this side of the divide, including Alaska and Canada, Alberta, BC. And I have, to be quite honest, I don't see anything here other than Crater Lake in Southern Oregon that even comes close to rising to the status of a national park. I mean, it's okay. It's pastoral at best, but I don't get this whole... I would feel pretty disappointed traveling 150 miles, 200 miles to go to a national park and end up in the Applegate or out, you know, in the Green Springs or something where they recently made a national monument. I mean,
what we're talking about here is
that I thought was a stretch. Mm-hmm. It was a real stretch.
All right, so let's get into designations here. When we're making national parks, are we making playgrounds for people, David Raines Wallace, or when we talk about national parks in terms of protection, we're really just looking for wilderness protection?
I think we're looking, one of the things we're looking for, I mean, we're looking for playgrounds, we're looking for wilderness protection, but also we're looking for biodiversity protection, and I think that, you know, the Klamath Mountains are a very characteristic aspect of North American biodiversity. The person that called before was talking about Kentucky and the Appalachians. Well, the counterpart of the Klamath Mountains in North America is the Southern Appalachians, which are a biosphere reserve centered on Great Smoky Mountains National Park. I think the Klamath Mountains should be a biosphere reserve with centered on, you know, on Oregon Caves and Siskiyou Crest National Park, because you have to have a national park as a center for a biosphere reserve. You know, for the three reasons I gave, because the forest is exceptionally diverse, the anadromous fishery is exceptionally diverse and healthy. And because the indigenous cultures are exceptionally diverse and healthy, and I think that's as I said, in places like Costa Rica, they don't just have national parks, you know, so people can come and say ooh ah. They have national parks because it's part of a program for protecting their natural resources, which include biodiversity as well as, you know, water, timber, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you mentioned Crater Lake. Crater Lake is spectacular, but it's not big enough, and it's not connected to other wild areas, so that it's become a kind of a poster child of loss of biodiversity. When it was established, there were all these species that lived there, and now most of them are gone, just because the whole area around that has been logged. So I think Crater Lake is an example of the failure of the 19th century concept of the national park is the ooh-ah place. Although that's it doesn't always in Yellowstone. It works because there's Yellowstone is the center of a much bigger area of wildlife habitat, Kelsey wildlife habitat.
David, just a couple minutes left. You wrote in one of these essays in 2005 that history has disproved sexism and racism. It has not proved Stephen Jay Gould's implicit corollary that no environmental limits exist to human desires. Is that still where you stand?
Oh yeah. That's certainly where I stand. I think that the evidence is accumulating all the time with things like climate change and resource depletion and monetary inflation. It's just getting more and more expensive to live. It's getting harder and harder for us to afford our lifestyle. I mean, I don't like to be a moralist about this because that's not my forte is not ethics, but it seems just obvious to me. Life is getting harder and harder to live at this. With the idea that you're going to succeed through getting more and more. I mean, that's what at least economics is based on, the idea of profit and success through accumulation, and that can only go so far in a limited environment. I mean, we used to think we could go to Mars and take over there, but Mars is not a very nice place. And the more we learn about outer space, the more hostile it seems. So that option sort of cut off. So I think we have to learn to live on this planet.
And there's much to learn in the essays in Articulate Earth, Adventures in Eco-Criticism. David Raines Wallace wrote the essays over the course of the last several decades. David, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, yeah, and thank you. And I'd like to say it's a pleasure to talk to somebody who's read the whole book, obviously with some insight. You don't always get to do that on an interview. So
glad to do it, man. Thank you.